Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have a very special guest with us today to do a preview of everybody's favorite. Did we decide it was a telenovela or some sort of sitcom, or how are we describing the North Korea summit?
Well, I think this is the moment where they really test the relationship and see if this is going to be fruitful in the long term. I think telenovela is pretty good. It's a new rom-com.
And I guess we should say, you know, I could ask us what we were drinking, but we're recording on Saturday morning. And we're not drinking a whole lot, actually.
I have a delicious LaCroix.
I myself am drinking coffee, but I imagine that after we finish recording, we'll all need a good stiff drink.
Yeah, I'm also drinking LaCroix here, so it's a very sober edition of Bombshell.
On the other hand, it's Pride weekend here in Washington, D.C., so I plan on having at least 39 mimosas later today as I celebrate on the way to the parade. Well, we are joined by a guest this week who's going to tell us exactly what is going to happen at the summit this week, and then exactly what it will happen afterward, unless, of course, you know, it all goes to hell, which it could easily do so. Alex Bell is the Senior Policy Director at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. She previously served in the State Department in the Undersecretary's Office for Arms Control and International Security, and we are delighted to have her here today. She has just more or less gotten off the plane from Singapore in the Shangri-La Dialogue, so she'll be able to tell us exactly how they're planning to receive their guests in the summit this week. But first, we have the very important bombshell questions, which I know that you've prepped for extensively. What is your entrance music?
First, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be on the show. The music thing is hard. I'm definitely one of those people that's always listening to music when I'm commuting, working out, all of that. So I thought about the context in which I would be entering somewhere. And my first thought was Killing in the Name of by Rage Against the Machine. That seems a little intense.
It works for me.
I kind of centered down on Down with Disease by Phish, just because the opening bass line is pretty epic.
Okay, those are good answers. We have not had either a Rage answer or a Phish answer.
Actually my first concert. Like, I know that is clear just looking at me and knowing me that I went to a Rage concert as my very first concert. And people were smoking pot behind me, and I was like, what if my mom knows? What is your most quoted movie line?
This is also a hard one, because I'm a huge movie buff, and I thought about the movie I quote the most lines from, and I think it's Tombstone. With
really?
Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer, by far Val Kilmer's best role. And
you know, I'm not sure if that's a competitive category or not.
Yeah, it's
come on.
Yeah, it may be a small grouping, but I always think about the line where he said, apparently Johnny Ringo is an educated man. Now I really hate him. I actually did consult with my boyfriend, and he said, great story, Hansel, is in fact the line I use the most for movies.
Mm-hmm. Zoolander explains everything in foreign policy.
It's really useful. There's a lot of good Zoolander out there.
Okay. What book does everyone else love but you can't stand?
I cannot stand 100 Years of Solitude.
Mm.
I've never wanted a book to be over so much in my life, but I was in the Peace Corps, and there's not much to do in your spare time when you have no money. Or a car or anything. So you spend a lot of time reading books, and that one was just painful to get
through. It's like the magical realism version of we're walking. Like, just like, is there a plot? Like, what is happening?
All the characters are terrible. I never got it.
I do like Love in the Time of Cholera, however. Okay, Alex, what is your favorite bar in the world?
This one was easier. So DC Bar, I'm a huge fan of the Looking Glass Lounge, but my favorite bar in the world is actually a bar called the Pelican Bar, and it's off the coast, actually in the water, in Parody, Jamaica. And there was a fisherman named Floyd who I met, who said it came to him in a dream to build this sort of ramshackle collection of bamboo and driftwood and tarp and palm fronds, and put it out on the sandbar. And it's pretty amazing. You can go out there and have jerk red snapper and cold red stripes and watch dolphins swim by. And
I'd take that.
Yeah.
All right, Radha.
What is the best use of data and statistics you've ever seen?
Again, I was trying to think of something cool or interesting to convey, and came back to a nuclear thing, which is just when we decided to stop testing nuclear weapons in 1992, we had to have a way to make sure that they were still safe, secure, and effective. And so we started something called the Stockpile Stewardship Program. And so it's physical maintenance of the nuclear weapons, but it's also, we took all the data that we had from the 1,000 nuclear tests we'd conducted and put it into this massive supercomputer. And when I say massive, it takes up an entire room about the size of a basketball court. And oh, wow. It takes all of that data and simulates nuclear explosions. We actually know more about nuclear weapons now and how they work than we did when we were blowing them up. So good use of data and a good reason why we can maintain the stockpile without testing.
That's an excellent answer. Radha, are you very impressed with that answer?
I am. I just liked so many different parts of it, including the fact that that program is an important part of the Department of Energy, which has a special place in my heart.
Indeed. Indeed. Okay, so now we have to shift gears to like less effervescent topics, I suppose.
Is anyone picturing like the moment, like where exactly are they going to meet? I'm imagining, on the runway as President Trump exits from Air Force One and Kim Jong-un is waiting in perhaps a field of flowers that is next to the runway. I'm not really sure why. And very slowly, the dun, 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 and they start playing and walking to each other. And do they hug? Do they shake hands? What happens?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like the Bachelor with nuclear weapons.
That's a great one.
So who gets the rose?
Yep.
So we have a summit in Singapore coming up that was the last time we talked was kind of off. And Lauren very presciently realized that it was definitely very likely probably going to be on again. And as always, she was right. And so now these folks are actually going to, I believe President Trump is leaving the G7 summit in Canada, which we'll get to in a minute.
Yep.
Today, so we're recording on Saturday, en route to Singapore to receive, or to meet on the tarmac with flowers and music blaring, Kim Jong-un. So can you remind us, Alex, just a little bit briefly, kind of how we got here this year? Because this is definitely not the conversation we were having 9 or 12 months ago.
Yeah. Last summer, we were all going to die.
100%.
Yep.
This winter, honestly, before the Olympics and the weeks leading up, it looked increasingly like we were heading towards a conflict with North Korea. And President Moon, who doesn't get enough credit for this, was able to take the pause that we got from the Olympics and sort of parlay that into the diplomatic opportunity that we have now. President Trump surprised the world when he said he would meet directly with Kim Jong-un. This is something that the Kim regime, the Kim dynasty has wanted forever, a direct meeting with the United States to sort of legitimize their rule over North Korea. So President Trump says, yes, let's meet. There didn't seem to be a lot of evidence of preparation for the technical parts of the meeting. There was a lot of guessing where it would be and, you know, kind of who would be there, but
and we know now that now Secretary of State Pompeo, but then Director of CIA, was doing some back channel coordination and engagement. I think initially with some counterparts in North Korea, and eventually with Kim himself.
Yeah, exactly. And meeting in country, which hadn't been done by a Secretary of State since Madeleine Albright in the 90s, and now we're looking at a summit. It sort of went off the rails after John Bolton and Vice President Pence both made reference to Libya, which was not the right reference point to make, even though the deposing of Gaddafi really had nothing to do with the weapons removal or the sort of the centrifuge removal that happened in the Bush administration.
Well, not directly,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was a bad reference to make. Libya never had a nuclear weapons program per se. They had some centrifuges, they had some chemical weapons and precursors, but a very different thing. Nevertheless, it was a bad reference point to make to a country that's very worried about its own regime's security. So then they sent very nice letters back and forth, and one of which came in a very big envelope. And, you know, Trump likes big sort of symbolic gestures like that. And so it looks like they're back on. And with the president sort of now saying that he's going to know, apparently by feel, if this is going to go well or not. It's not crazy in the idea that chemistry matters here.
Yeah, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so President Reagan and President Gorbachev, it was not only the sort of set of circumstances leading up to Reykjavik, but their personalities and their sort of connection to each other that made things like the INF Treaty possible. It's, you know, the rapport between Kerry and Zarif and Secretary Moniz and his counterpart, I think, made the Iran deal process go more smoothly. Rose Gottemuller and Anatoly Antonov, who were the main negotiators on the New START treaty, had a good professional working relationship that helped get through some of the trickier issues when negotiating that treaty. So chemistry is important. It's also important to know what you're talking about. And that's where I start to get a little concerned.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned earlier, kind of some questions around what the preparations had been. What's your sense of where both the, let's call it like the White House team or the kind of executive office team might be, and where the broader interagency, civil service, disarmament, negotiations crowd might be at this point in the process?
This seems like a very top-down approach. It's not altogether apparent that there's a lead person at the State Department as far as the technical workings of this, like Ambassador Wendy Sherman. The main expert on this, Joseph Yun, retired just a little bit right after the announcement that Trump would meet with Kim Jong-un. And I think they're playing a little catch-up now, trying to make sure that their technical experts at least consulting. It's not clear that the Bureaus of Arms Control, Verification and Compliance and International Security and Nonproliferation will even be at the summit. I think that's a mistake. You need that kind of technical expertise, at least whispering behind you as you're talking about these big picture issues.
So the comparison that's come to mind to me a lot is that we have been focusing a great deal on it's like a wedding. We've been focusing on the invitation and the location and the choreography and what it all looks like and what's going to come out of that day. But the people always forget about the fact that afterwards you actually have to be married. and you've kind of like, you've bought more than that one person. You now have like an entire group of in-laws to deal with and a life to plan together and figure out how to make that work. And I know that this is something that you cared a lot about is that the implementation piece of whatever they agree, and that could be, you know, maybe to be a perfect agreement and like suddenly we'll have no nuclear weapons program in North Korea, unlikely. But even if it's a small thing, it's going to be difficult and take a lot of work to be able to manage from the both United States side as well as the international community in North Korea. Like what will that process look like, particularly on the US side?
It's going to take years, even if there's a good outcome at this summit. And it does seem like President Trump is starting to acknowledge that this summit is the start of the process and not an end in and of itself. That's somewhat heartening. But arms control and nonproliferation agreements are incredibly tedious. And technical implementation of them it gets derailed. There are lots of obstacles. You need to constantly be tending to it. I was trying to think of a real-world application of it. All I could think of is dealing with the cable company. You feel like you've made a deal with the cable company and what they're going to provide you and how much it's going to cost. And they're constantly changing things. And if you're not watching your bill, all of a sudden you're paying for like the Earth's, you know, rotational access is slightly off. So there's a $20 fee for that. And you're like, what? You constantly have to be looking. It's the same thing with arms control and nonproliferation agreements. It's just human nature that countries are going to just try to maybe skirt some of the rules, use opportunities to sort of get around the things they find unpleasant in the deal. You just have to tend to it and manage it constantly. And it tends to get embroiled in politics when that happens. And people want to point out that someone's done a bad job negotiating because something's slightly askew in the deal. We really need to take politics out of this and sort of unleash the technocrats to do what they do.
So what are you going to be looking for in kind of the immediate aftermath of the summit and the kind of weeks following the rest of the summer let's assume that there was a good outcome reasonably productive meeting and both sides come away saying something generally positive, even if maybe they didn't get exactly on the same page with whatever denuclearization actually means. Mm-hmm. What will you keep an eye on to know if things are working, if things are fraying, and if there's actual, as you say, some of these good working relationships that actually might get to technical implementation of a meaningful agreement?
I think it'd be looking for the creation of a team with a clear leader who's empowered and has the voice, you know, the ear of the president, and that team deployed to wherever we decide to do these negotiations. Geneva is a place where we've done things with Russia in the past. It's not as applicable here. So I don't know if it's in South Korea. I don't know if it's in Singapore, but you're going to need a team on the ground working with a North Korean team for weeks, if not months, to hammer out the particulars of this deal. We learned our lesson with the agreed framework in 1994 that was about, I don't know, 4 pages long. The Iran deal, by comparison, was 173 pages long. If you look at really intense deals like the ones we've made with Russia in the past, the technical annexes alone get into the hundreds of pages, 900 pages of very specific technical details. Those are the things that are going to have to happen if we're really going to make progress with the North Koreans. And you're adding the complication to the fact that we're trying to pull ballistic missiles into this as well, apparently. And that makes it even more complicated. Our record on ballistic missile deals is less lengthy than the stuff we've done on nuclear.
We were talking about before we got started, there is a problem of focusing only on the United States, North Korea aspects of this negotiation, but there's clearly a lot of other players. You mentioned in South Korea, but also we have not paid as much attention, I think, overall to China and how they are either supporting or not necessarily supporting how North Korea's posture to go into this negotiation. Can you, either Aaron, also do you have a question on that? And I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this.
Oh yeah, I'm like super interested in what the Chinese have been up to, because we talked a few weeks ago that it seemed like they maybe had been cut out. It was a very Korean-led process, North and South together. The Chinese were kind of on the sidelines, but then there were a number of additional trips that Kim, I guess, made to China. And then there's this whole ZTE thing. And so I don't want to say that I'm prone to conspiracy theories, but I do read a lot of spy novels. And so I'm definitely interested in your thoughts on both like what the Chinese are up to and kind of what their role is in the process now, but also what role this ZTE situation played.
First, Xi's no dummy. He was never going to be outside of this process. And not the least of which reason is a deal with North Korea won't work without Chinese pressure. Sort of pushing the implementation the same way we needed the Russians to keep an elbow in the back of the Syrians to do the chemical weapons removal and the Iranians as well. So you need China in the game. China does not want to sit on the sidelines as the U.S. Negotiates this deal. You've also got the South Koreans and the Japanese with their own specific desires of what they want out of the deal, a lot of human rights issues that they want to bring in, abduction. And also they're very worried about a possible deal that the United States could make that might work for us and wouldn't work for them. Troop withdrawal from South Korea is one of the things I think that's really bothering them. But Russia also, I think, wants a piece of this, and which is how we used to kind of work through this issue with the North Koreans, is in this big scrum of 6 different countries. It didn't really work. So there's something to be said for just trying to take a one-on-one approach, or at least U.S., South Korea, North Korea all together. But China's not going to let go and just let other people run the show here.
Do we make some sort of back-channel deal on ZTE?
I can't for the life of me understand what's going on there. And you're seeing some concern, even amongst Republicans who've had good relationships with Trump, like Senator Cotton, who's a little alarmed about this deal.
I have to say, I mean, and I'll get off this rock in a second, but we talked about this a couple weeks ago. ZTE is this Chinese technology company that was including malware and other nefarious code in its devices that it was exporting to the U.S. And we had originally slapped sanctions on them and banned them. They also were selling to Iran, which was in violation of the Iranian sanctions. So we put substantial sanctions on, and then all of a sudden we rolled them off. And yeah, it just sort of, it's a very, I would love to believe that it was part of like a well-orchestrated, like quid pro quo, you know, pull this off in order to get them to bring North Korea to the back to the table on something or another. It's not obvious to me we're quite that well coordinated, but it's almost, it would almost be better if we were. So it remains pretty interesting to me.
Or that we can trust if we made a deal that they're going to maintain it.
Well, we're very excited for the summit, and we'll look forward to following you on Twitter and getting commentary in the weeks and days to follow. So thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's keep up some foreign relations off the top, and we're not going to dive into these too deeply, but I think they're both topics that we'll keep an eye on over time here a bit. One, there's been ongoing protests in Jordan, which I kind of randomly keep an eye on, because when I used to be in meetings on counter ISIS campaign or other things, you would always hear people say, you know, when you ask, like, what are you most worried about? People often said Jordan, which always surprised me. And that was because Jordan is a really important counterpart and partner for us in the region, especially on special operations activities, but also because as a the political entities there, the institutions are maybe not as strong as we would always like them to be. And so there were protests in Jordan related to new fiscal policies, in particular taxes that were part of a, if not quite IMF restructuring deal, then certainly IMF directed policy changes to get their accounts in order. They have a very, very high debt to GDP ratio. The protests were pretty widespread, and there was a new announcement after the prime minister got dismissed that they would repeal, or they would not put this new tax forward. And I actually saw a report this morning that there'll be a meeting with Jordan, Saudi, UAE, and Kuwait to kind of get some regional help to try to get the Jordanian fiscal house in order. So that was an interesting piece that we definitely want to follow there. Jordanian political instability is not something anybody looks forward to.
That's right. And then there was also a brief mention here. There was one U.S. Special Operation Forces killed and four wounded in Somalia. So this was a Jubaland attack that happened on June 8th. So just about a day ago, a little bit more from when we're recording. There was also one of our partner forces were killed. So just as a reminder for folks, we have about 500 U.S. troops there and a broader sort of international coalition of African forces, including including Kenyan forces fighting Al-Shabaab. So Al-Shabaab is the East Africa Al-Qaeda group, and we've been sort of there in various iterations for an extended period of time. Just a good reminder that we do have ongoing operations in East Africa, and those forces are sort of actively combating a continued Al-Qaeda presence there.
So before we dig into the G7 and trade contretemps from this weekend, there's actually been a number of reports on Chinese espionage. And as I mentioned, since I love a good spy novel, but I actually don't love espionage in the real world per se. It's a little creepier to think about. Rod, can you bring us a little bit up to speed on like what's happened and what the major malfunction is here?
Yeah. So just as a bit of color to this, as I started digging into this, it turned out that there were even more cases than I had realized. So let me sort of break up this into active, like sort of recruitment and use of U.S. individuals to spy for the Chinese. So there was the CIA recruited a contractor, Kevin Malloy, who has just been convicted. There was also a DIA case officer, Ron Rockwell Hansen, and a CIA officer, Jerry Chun Shinbi, who in varying combinations provided information on U.S. Presence in the region and U.S. activities, U.S. CIA presence and sort of objectives, and then internal information about U.S. sort of priorities and strategies, which isn't great. And it's clear that the Chinese have been on a pretty aggressive mission to recruit and turn U.S. individuals in the know to get them information. At the same time, there's been direct Chinese action. So there was just a report that China breached U.S. Navy contractor laptops to access sensitive information related to our submarine force. That information was technically unclassified, but the Navy did say that there's a lot of detailed sensitive information that, if combined appropriately, could be considered classified, and certainly they consider to be risky, which does beg the question why it's labeled unclassified and shared relatively freely on contractor laptops and in contractor storage systems. And just as a last reminder, China was sort of publicly discussed from the OPM breach that happened a couple of years ago. And that was a tremendous amount of detailed information about a whole lot of U.S. individuals who had background checks and security clearances, which sort of begs the question of how that plays into their effectiveness in recruiting and hacking and getting information otherwise.
Yeah, that was definitely my first question when this came out. I was like, so are they just like spinning the dial through their OPM files and seeing, you know, who's got the highest debt loads or would otherwise be vulnerable to recruitment? At least in two of the cases, it seemed that financial distress was the main factor, which in some ways is kind of interesting. It's different from some of the insider threat discussions that we've had in the last few years related to Snowden and others. in that financial distress is the Aldrich Ames profile from right. back in the early 1990s. And it is the set of questions that you do answer a lot on your SF-86, which is how much debt you have and if you have a gambling problem. Most of the questions are actually related to your financial situation. So it's a little bit interesting from a CI perspective that those concerns are still in play. But incredibly concerning to me that they have incredible dossiers basically on every person with an active clearance, or at least it was, you know, current as of 2012 or 2013, and can spin their dial to find, you know, locate folks who might be effective recruits. We don't know that that's exactly what they've done in these cases, obviously, right. but it definitely sets up a risk profile or that makes me really, really uncomfortable. It also reminded me, Radha, I don't know if you remember, there was a story in the Times almost exactly a year ago about the Chinese rolling up a U.S. spy ring in China. And so yep. we see pretty active recruitment of U.S. targets by Chinese agents and also effective counterintelligence by the Chinese against efforts that we've made on the other side. So I don't know. There's not a lot of easy answers, I think, here particularly, but just a reminder that we're actually in a pretty adversarial information environment on some of these sensitive topics. And that's going to be an ongoing. It used to be a pattern, or used to be a pattern of habit, a set of habits for folks who worked in national security in the Cold War. But I think we haven't tended to think about those things in quite the same way in the last 20 years.
It also makes us remember the value of having things like cyber coordinators and sort of thinking strategically about some of our information security, both offensively and defensively. And I think we'll talk a little bit later about some of the NSC and general bureaucracy changes in White House mayhem. But, you know, we are in an era of complicated relationships with allies and adversaries, and a big portion of that is our cybersecurity.
Just a reminder to everyone, President Trump tweets on an unsecured phone.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there was a new report this week that confirmed that John Kelly's phone had been compromised last year. So, yes, this is, you know, there's some basic operational security that goes, or ComSec, that goes along with the technical pieces, which just makes for fun for everyone. Okay, so
speaking of presidential tweets.
Yeah, no kidding. What is happening at the G7 this week?
So we're recording on Saturday, effectively as much of the G7 is more or less wrapping up, or at least the President Trump has departed, as he departed early. Going into the G7, just as a reminder for folks, it is shockingly a group of seven nations. The United States, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, with the EU as kind of an observer partner that goes along. It used to be the G8. We kicked out Russia after their invasion of Crimea a few years ago, but that may be subject to change. Going into this, my sense is, from particularly our European partners, there was a greater sense of despair and alarm ahead of this meeting than there had been ahead of prior European gatherings with the Trump administration. And I think that not shockingly, due to a lot of the trade dispute and tariff imposition that this administration has put on. But also, I think they're coming to the same realization that we have come to domestically, at least maybe 6 months ago, that all of Trump's campaign positions in foreign policy, frankly, the long-running positions he's had on trade being a more or less a zero-sum game, his cozying up to autocrats, bashing allies, these aren't just superficial things for him. These are fundamental part of his tenets and beliefs. And while he may have been held back in the prior year because he was either not comfortable with his position or had advisors that held him back, he is no longer feeling shy about implementing any of these. So that takes meetings like this from a, like, okay, kind of awkward get together and talk, put out an agreement at the end, to a far more adversarial conversation.
To the point where we apparently objected to the inclusion of the phrase rules-based international order, which is like, to the extent that we have a strategy, that's it. And so for the U.S. to object to that, I mean, almost literally blew my mind. And I mean, we do lots of things that at times undermine the rules-based international order. Don't get me wrong on that front. But to object to the anodyne inclusion in the statement.
We flog that in basically everything to the point where it's become a buzzword that no one understands. Now, to put a little cold water on some of the panic going on right now in the social medias, the rifts amongst the allies that get together and chat at these sessions are to some degree a feature and not a bug. Like, that's why we have groups like this, is to be able to keep talking through divisions. I mean, people may recall the Iraq War, which was not exactly put us on the best of terms with our European partners, as well as a number of events in the Reagan administration related to, you know, placement of intermediate range missiles and other just big divisions that we have had. But the kind of emotional language being used right now in terms of, I have saw one German envoy say that it felt as though discovering your father is abusive and can no longer support you, that you're going into divorce that will no longer be reparable. There's a lot of sort of familial language that, you know, resonates with me quite a bit in terms of analogies, as well as a decision to fundamentally band against Trump in coming up with their own policies. You've seen Macron, to some degree Merkel, to some degree Trudeau, try to cozy up to him individually, but the gloves have come off as they get together, and it's basically, you know, one man against a room of people who are showing on their face, you can see in the photos, that they despise and loathe him, which has got to be a fun dinner conversation.
One of the things that strikes me, and I want Radha to dig into it in just a second, which is that the degree to which the security institutions, security alignments that make up part of the rules-based order, in particular NATO, really have economic base underneath them. And, you know, as a political scientist and as a security person, like, I've just never spent that much time paying attention to trade, and certainly didn't spend a lot of time paying attention to the domestic political implications of trade, which is 100% why we're all here in this situation right now. But the ability for an organization like NATO to do burden sharing the way it does was also really rested on the Bretton Woods framework as much as it rested on the actual security guarantees. And so we're in kind of, we're going to have to actually create a new segment, I feel like, on tariffs or on the trade pieces, because it's so hard to follow what we've announced, what we've actually implemented, what the allies have counter-announced, what concessions we've made to China but not made to Japan or whatnot. And so, Radha, can you kind of walk us through a little bit of how the tariff situation drives that G7 tension and also where we are right now?
Yeah, so I'm not going to go through all of the many different versions of tariffs.
Oh, come on. I want to know about the milk tariffs.
I know. The big things to remember are aluminum and steel tariffs should go into effect July 1, which is in just under a month now. And those bite hard on a number of our European allies. The other thing I think that about sums up the discussion is there are reports that Donald Trump said to so Donald Trump came to the trade discussion with a list of trade related complaints for each individual country and went through them one by one. So, like,
basically a live reading of his tweets.
Right. And to Justin Trudeau, he said, you know, you can basically save your teary eyed, heart string tugging speeches on fighting side by side with us in wars. Like, get rid of your dairy tariffs and let U.S. dairy be competitive in Canada, or like, we're going to slap some tariffs on you and like stop with all the our guys are dying side by side, which is a really, on the one hand, shocking, like, this isn't how we talk to like literally our closest, both geographically and economically partner. But on the other hand, like all things Trump related to these economic issues, there's like a kernel of truth here. So just as a reminder, the Trump administration has we've talked a lot about tariffs, but actually what the Trump administration is trying to do is create cost competitiveness for U.S. industries in a bunch of fronts. So agriculture, manufacturing, specifically related to steel and aluminum, also related to cars. There are a number of ways to do that. The way the Trump administration has talked about doing it is tariffs, which are taxes on foreign goods. That means it raises the prices of foreign goods that consumers in the U.S. will pay, making U.S. Products, which might be higher price, cost competitive. An alternative to that, which a number of countries, including Canada, do, is subsidize their own industries, right? Which that reduces the cost of domestic production so that foreign goods that come in are now that are cheaper are now the same price as your domestic goods. So a couple of implications there. One, lots of countries have subsidies for their domestic industries, especially ones that they consider important. We do it too on agriculture. Canada does both tariffs and subsidies on the dairy industry, and this is a recent change in their rules have made ultra-filtered milk, which used to be U.S.'s primary entry into the dairy market in Canada, cost competitive, now not cost competitive. So there are rules, and Trump did sort of riff on the idea of, like, let's have a actual free trade zone where there are no subsidies, tariffs, or anything. And everyone kind of looked like awkwardly at each other.
Sure the sugar producers of America are going to be super excited about that.
Exactly. So the second bit is, though, that the tariff focus has really sort of resonated with Trump's base in the sense of like sticking it to those Europeans. What people may or may not have noticed is that that is going to make it more expensive for Americans to buy stuff, right? Tariffs are taxes. They're taxes on goods. They're taxes on foreign goods. And the reason that U.S. industries are losing or are not competitive is because people are buying cheaper goods. So if tariffs are effective at making U.S. industries competitive, that is because you are now paying more for stuff. And so how that plays out sort of in the medium run and the extent to which the Trump administration realizes there are tariffs, which forces the companies to bear the incidence rather than subsidies, which the U.S. government would bear the cost of, and sort of with OMB leadership where it is, may or may not be sort of politically or economically palatable, remains to be seen. And at the end of the day, we don't have a lot of forward progress on the trade discussion with European allies. And I think, you know, we're going to have to see how that plays out relative to all of the other security needs that we actually need for that.
Next time I'm going to make you talk about non-tariff barriers. We're going to blow everybody's mind. Okay, that's awesome, Radha. So we have a really, I mean, the Europeanists are really quite alarmed, right? Japan really is part of that mix, although obviously it's not in Europe. But they, you know, Japan, for example, did not get relief from the steel tariffs, even though Abe lobbied very hard for them. That's also occurring, if we want to shift gears slightly, to White House mayhem in the context of a shakeup or the ongoing fallout from this new national security team. So we have Pompeo at State and John Bolton running the National Security Council, or is he?
Yeah. We talked about, slightly over a month ago, as both of these folks came in, that it would be interesting to watch how they performed in the North Korea summit and G7 and NATO. Like these were basically areas where they were going to have to like hit the ground running and immediately have a lot of high profile initiatives going on. And if I was a betting woman, I would start to put my money on Pompeo in being the biggest Trump whisperer, the one who will really be running the foreign policy behind the scenes, and the one that will have the trust of the president to implement an actual agenda going forward, to the extent that we have an agenda. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, we have seen Bolton probably get his hand slapped on North Korea for being the one who started using the Libya model that we talked about earlier in the show. And to the extent that he is taking a backseat role and possibly being banned for some meetings with the North Koreans, both led by the president, but also ones that Pompeo is doing himself, which, to not have the National Security Advisor being a lead face in such negotiations, is kind of a big deal. Not like a mind-blowingly career-ending deal, but it's kind of a big deal and deserves watching. On top of which, with we did mention this at the G7, President Trump introduced the idea of bringing Russia back into the fold, which is hardly aligns in any way, shape, or form with what we know about John Bolton. He is a Russia hawk, Russia hater. He would never support that unless we were getting something significant out of the deal.
You know, and it strikes me that like 2 years ago, Pompeo was
congressman
from Kansas,
but he is an exceptional politician.
Really is.
He has earned the trust of the president. He has managed to get himself, people may remember him from the Benghazi hearings. He wrote the kind of addendum to that report that got a lot of play, didn't get any sign-ons from most of the rest of the House, but had he caught the notice of Trump by being so hard on Clinton. He, you know, whether or not you follow this or not and think that Senator Cotton was kept out of the CIA role in order to not have a competitor to him in order to get Trump's ear, and instead putting in Gina Haspel, like, I think that there's possibly some truth to that.
It also strikes me that I think he's a decent manager.
Yeah.
And whether that's sort of, you know, lingering army training or Midwestern pragmatism or something that, you know, he lets people actually, like, lets the bureaucracy work, not overkill on that front, but basically seems to get the organizational strengths to run behind him in a way that, you know, certainly Tillerson was never able to do at State. And so now he might be able to do a little bit of effectively get the underlying organizations to support him in his efforts to help the president. But this Trump whisperer piece, I mean, I've even seen people speculate that he could end up in a Kissinger role where he is dual-hatted.
Yep.
is therefore both national security advisor and secretary of state, which that would be legitimately crazy pants to my mind.
Now, unfortunately, I think there were a lot of headlines after Pompeo came on board about how he would be restoring state's role in the national security apparatus and ceasing a lot of the bad actions under Tillerson. But a couple of unfortunate things have put cold water on that he is not actually able to reverse the hiring freeze as much as he might otherwise desire. Right now, basically, due to other hiring caps put in by the administration, he can't go back and say all those positions that weren't hired against for this last year and a half can go back and be filled. It's only about 6 months of positions that were under that. So that's a big negative. On top of which, there is a report ostensibly coming out from OMB in a couple of weeks to fundamentally reorganize the U.S. government. This is one of many reports that have come out over many decades. So we'll see where it goes. But a key feature of it is, again, major cuts to the State Department and USAID. So regardless of Pompeo's view of state, it's clear that the folks who are actually counting the dollars and running the White House don't agree with this.
Well, that's Mick Mulvaney. So he would certainly, it'll be interesting to see if Pompeo fights that. Tillerson certainly didn't fight hard in the first round. Speaking of reports, there is also a new report on civilian casualties from the Defense Department.
Yeah, there sure is. So the Defense Department periodically releases these reports on counts of civilian casualties from various operations. They released one that covered a couple different operations just last week. That was great, or actually just this week passed. But it met with some controversy, and there are sort of two groups of controversy on this. One is that when pressed on some of the numbers and estimates, the Department of Defense spokesman's response was, well, we never really know how many civilians are killed ever. There's no source of truth in that, as you might imagine, went over great. And the second is Amnesty report, sort of deep dive into the Raqqa offensive and bombings by the U.S. found alleged that the U.S. Undertook a number of strikes that were contrary to international law, that unnecessarily put civilians at risk, that didn't appropriately consider civilian casualties in the targeting and determination of those. The Department of Defense has pushed back on them and pointed to some of the decision criteria, but I think sort of bigger picture, this really highlights this ongoing tension that we the U.S. and the Department of Defense have really faced on the one hand of trying to push forward on a number of these urban campaigns, in this case in Syria, but in the past in Iraq and in the past in Afghanistan, while trying to minimize civilian casualties and then sort of being relatively transparent about what they're doing without necessarily being in any way transparent about the methodology by which they count things or sort of addressing some of the issues. Now, in fairness to DOD, they have adjusted their estimates in response to credible reporting and approaches by groups like Amnesty International and the International Coalition of the Red Cross. But those are from past administrations, and we'll sort of see how this administration takes in external feedback on these reports.
So to make two points on that, to add on to what Radha just briefed, one key feature of all of this is that there is no agreement between the Department of Defense or the international community or NGOs in how to actually count civilian casualties. Like, there's not an agreed upon methodology in terms of how Amnesty works versus how other organizations do. There's several journalistic organizations that do this, as well as DOD. Nor does DOD have a good system thus far for taking on board non-government information and how it does this. And that's a limitation that I know a lot of folks are concerned about, but are also working on. And then second, we've talked about before that DOD is really limited in two ways in their ability to actually prevent civilian casualties right now, because they are primarily conducting air operations with very few limited presence on the ground. And then as a result of that, limited in their ability to actually count them, again, by doing monitoring from the air, primarily with some reporting that they take from the folks who are based on the ground, which is a fundamentally different circumstance to where we were in Iraq 10 years ago, as well as Afghanistan, frankly, even now. And we have not kind of evolved our practice and thinking on that while still doing as much as possible to prevent civilian casualties, have not really kind of come to grips with the fact that we're in a different place than we were 10 years ago in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And we're also in a different media environment. I mean, it strikes me that these would have been reasonably big, splashy reports at one point, you know, 10 years ago or even 5 or 6 years ago, if there'd been systematic underreporting of civilian casualties. I mean, Radha, we worked on this in Afghanistan. I mean, it was a literal strategic issue. Now, I mean, it barely made a blip. I mean, there's just so much else going on, and it's certainly not the Defense Department's top priority, and even less so the White House's. So I think that that's it's a challenge on the reporting front. I think it's important to think about the methods there, but it's also a challenge on the political and oversight front as we go forward. So speaking of some political and media challenges, we want to introduce a new segment called, well, for now, Soapbox, but perhaps we'll come up with something punchier in the future. And I'm going to take the prerogative of our first Soapbox segment and discuss the Google decision to stop not to renew its Project Maven contract. So Google recently announced that they were not renewing their Project Maven contract, which is a contract with the Department of Defense to focus on AI or machine learning solutions for processing streaming video. In practice, that means real-time processing of drone footage, and they wanted more automated ways of doing this. It turns out that there was a number of concerns among engineers at Google, especially from their subsidiary at DeepMind, and that first was a letter that merged into a large petition that they wanted to stop work on this project and thought it was inappropriate for Google to do this work with the Department of Defense. My first response was really quite snarky, which was that Google employees needed to learn about the history of the internet and GPS and a number of other technologies, all of which were defense funded, and not just defense funded, but were funded by research on defense weapon systems. But the more I thought about it, the more I really actually wanted to find ways to grapple with these questions and take their concerns seriously, which was that they thought that this research, while not on a related to a specific weapon system, could be used to create autonomous weapons in the future. And that in that process, that something about that process is sort of inherently escalatory with regard to conflict dynamics. And I think the reason it's important to take it seriously is not because it's correct per se, but because it reveals an incredible East Coast, West Coast rift with regard to how these technologies are developed and what they're likely to be used for. Google has now released a statement of principles and guidelines on all of its future AI work, including that they will not work on any autonomous weapons or surveillance technology. And the statement itself is actually fairly interesting, if somewhat anodyne, and could certainly be applied to a number of civilian projects, commercial projects in the tech sector. But the question I was really left with was, what does kind of the revolt by Google engineers mean and Google's subsequent decisions mean for DoD's strategy of pursuing innovation through commercial off-the-shelf technology? If they can't buy what we would call COTS goods, if they can't buy commercially available services to pursue any number of personnel management and information processing capabilities, where does that leave them? And I think it leaves them with having to bring it in-house. And that has all kinds of implications for personnel and, honestly, security classification reform. Thus ends my soapbox.
Pop culture?
Yes, pop culture. Excellent. Okay. We've been watching movies on airplanes and or while traveling. Who else? I watched the Hedy Lamarr Bombshell documentary.
Me too. It was so good.
It was really interesting.
I didn't know anything about her.
So basically, Hedy Lamarr was like the most gorgeous woman on the planet for a 20-year period. She was born in Austria and left just prior to World War II. And she invented frequency hopping, which basically is the technology that lets you have Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, and any number of other like secure communications that you would use in like anti-submarine warfare. And so,
yeah, and in fact, was used by the Department of Defense and publicly acknowledged. I mean,
yeah,
in real time, like her patent.
Well, the acknowledgement didn't happen in real time. The acknowledgement happened many years later. Anyway, that was kind of a cool story. Lauren, did you have some airplane?
I watched like 7 movies in the last 4 days. So I have finally gotten through Red Sparrow, The Last Jedi, Death of Stalin, and a couple other things. And Death of Stalin is the only one of those that I will highly recommend to everyone on the planet. Red Sparrow, like, did they read the book?
I know.
Did they just look at the cover?
Right.
And then, like, it just makes zero sense from a plot perspective or espionage or motivations.
It totally missed what made the book great.
On top of which, Nate is not hot. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I expected him at least to be hot.
You don't like Joel Edgerton? He's not doing it for you?
He just was kind of slightly pudgy and overweight and dad body in this version.
Sad.
Anyway, and then The Last Jedi, I just want to be like, I don't understand why most of it existed. Like, there seemed to be no plot that it appeared to be advancing. I wanted to like it. It just didn't make a lot of sense. I tried. I tried really hard to like it. I love the fight scenes. Fight scenes were great.
I still haven't seen Solo. I assume Radha hasn't seen Solo. Have you seen Solo?
I have not seen Solo.
And I've seen disappointing reviews for Ocean's 8, which I need to get a verdict on because that should be super fabulous.
It has to be great. I will go in like mildly intoxicated just to make it great.
Well, let's find a way to make that happen. I'm also, okay. Incredibles 2 is out in like a week, which I've literally been waiting, 15 years for. So I'm very, very excited about.
You can take my 3-year-old. Happily. That'd be great.
Yeah, I'm just going to duct tape him to the chair and we'll, when it's over, we can wave. Anything else, ladies?
This has been a delightful episode.
But I think we will all be together for our next episode.
Yes, hooray! We will. We will. And we'll have
special guests next time.
We'll have some very special guests next time, indeed. So, all right. Thanks, everybody. Bye.